All the basics. Even an iron and ironing board. Very considerate of him, Hoshino thought, though I imagine his secretary did all the work. They haven't forgotten a thing. He opened the cupboard and found fresh underwear and clothes. No Aloha shirts, unfortunately, just some ordinary striped shirts and polo shirts, brand new Tommy Hilfigers. And here I was thinking Colonel Sanders was pretty quick on the uptake, Hoshino complained to no one in particular. He should have spotted that I only wear Aloha shirts. If he went to all this trouble, he could at least have bought me one. He noticed the shirt he had on was getting a bit rank, so took it off and pulled on a polo shirt. It was a perfect fit. They walked through the pines, up over a breakwater, and down to the beach. The inland sea was calm. They sat down side by side on the sand, not speaking for a long time, watching the waves rise up like sheets being fluffed into the air, and then, with a faint sound, break apart. Several small islands were visible offshore. Neither of them had been to the sea very often in their lives, and they feasted their eyes on the scene.
"Mr. Hoshino," Nakata said, breaking the silence.
"What is it?"
"The sea is a really nice thing, isn't it?"
"Yeah, it is. Makes you feel calm."
"Why is that?"
"Probably 'cause it's so big, with nothing on it," Hoshino said, pointing. "You wouldn't feel so calm if there was a 7-Eleven over there, or a Seiyu department store, would you? Or a pachinko place over there, or a Yoshikawa pawn shop? But as far as the eye can see, there's nothing, which is pretty darn nice."
"I suppose you're right," Nakata said, giving it some thought. "Mr. Hoshino?"
"What's up?"
"I have a question about something else."
"Shoot."
"What's at the bottom of the sea?"
"There's like another world down there. All kinds of fish, shellfish, seaweed and stuff. You never been to an aquarium?"
"No, I've never been. The place where Nakata lived for a long time, Matsumoto, didn't have one of those."
"No, I don't imagine it would," Hoshino said. "A town like that, off in the hills, I guess a mushroom museum or something would be about all you could expect. Anyhow, there's all kinds of stuff at the bottom of the sea. The animals are different to us. They take oxygen from the water and don't need air to breathe. There's some beautiful things down there, some delicious things. Plus some dangerous things, and things that would totally freak you out. If you've never seen it, it's hard to explain, but it's completely different to what we're used to. Way down at the bottom, it's dark, and there are some of the grossest creatures you've ever seen. What do you say when all this blows over, we check out an aquarium? They're kind of fun, and I haven't been to one in a long time. I'm sure there's one around here."
"Yes, I'd love to go to a place like that."
"There's something I wanted to ask you."
"Yes?"
"The other day we lifted up that stone and opened the entrance, right?"
"Yes, you and I opened up the entrance. After that, Nakata fell sound asleep."
"What I want to know is, did something take place because the entrance opened up?"
Nakata gave a nod.
"Yes, it did."
"But you still don't know what that is?"
Nakata gave a decisive shake of his head.
"No, Nakata doesn't know yet."
"So maybe it's happening somewhere else, right this minute."
"Yes, I think that's true. As you said, it's happening, and I'm waiting for it to finish happening."
"And once, whatever it is, finishes taking place, everything will work itself out."
Another definitive shake of the head.
"That Nakata doesn't know. I'm doing what I'm doing because I must. I have no idea what will happen because of what I do, though. I'm not so bright, so it's too hard for me to work out. I don't know what's going to happen."
"At any rate, it's going to take some time, right? For whatever this is to finish up, and some conclusion or something to happen."
"That is correct. And while we're waiting, we have to make sure the police don't grab us, 'cause there's still stuff that needs doing."
"Correct.
I don't mind visiting the police. I'm ready to do whatever the governor tells me to do, but now is just not a good time to do that."
"You know what? If the police heard your crazy story, they'd just brush it off and make up some convenient confession, something anyone would believe.
like you were robbing the house and you heard somebody, so you picked up a knife from the kitchen and stabbed him. They don't give a damn what the real facts are or what's right. Framing somebody just to jack up their arrest rate, they wouldn't bat an eye. Next thing you know, you're thrown in jail or some maximum security psycho ward. They'd lock you up and throw away the key. You don't have enough money to hire some fancy lawyer, so they'd stick you with some court-appointed bozo who couldn't care less, so it's obvious how it'd end up.
I'm afraid I don't understand, or I'm just telling you what the police are like. Believe me, I know,
Hoshino said. So I really don't want to take them on, okay? Police and me just don't hit it off.
I'm sorry to cause so many problems for you.
Hoshino sighed deeply. As they say, though, take the poison, take the plate.
What does that mean?
If you're going to take poison, you might as well eat the plate it came on.
But if you eat a plate, you'll die. It's not good for your teeth, either. And it'll hurt your throat.
I'd have to agree, Hoshino said, puzzling over it.
Yeah, why do you have to eat the plate?
I'm not so bright, so I really can't tell you. But aside from the poison, the plate's way too hard.
Oh, you got that right. I'm starting to get confused myself. I never was one for using my head either.
What I'm trying to say is, I've come this far, so I'll stick with you and make sure you escape. I can't believe you did anything bad, and I'm not going to just abandon you here. I've got my honour to consider. Much obliged. Nakata can't thank you enough. I'll presume on you again, though, and ask one more favour.
Go for it.
We'll need a car.
Would a rental car be okay?
Nakata doesn't really know what that is, but any kind is fine. Big or small is all right, as long as it's a car.
No problem. Now you're talking my speciality. I'll go and pick one up in a while.
So we're going to be heading out somewhere? I think so. We probably will be heading out somewhere.
You know something, Mr. Nakata?
Yes?
I never get bored when I'm with you. All kinds of off-the-wall things happen, but this much I can say for sure. Being with you's never boring.
Thank you for saying that. I feel relieved to hear it. But Mr. Hoshino...
What's up?
I'm not really sure I understand what being bored means.
You never been bored before?
No, not even once. You know, I kind of had the feeling that might be the case.
37. We stop at a town to have a bite to eat and stock up on food and mineral water at a supermarket, then drive up the unpaved road through the hills and arrive at the cabin. Inside, it's exactly as I left it a week ago. I open the window to air the place, then stow the food. I'm going to take a nap before I head back, Oshima says, nearly covering his face with his hands as he lets out a huge yawn. I didn't sleep well last night. He really must be exhausted, because as soon as he gets under the covers and turns towards the wall, he's out. I make some coffee and pour it into a thermos for his drive back, then head down to the brook with the aluminium pail to fill up on water. The forest hasn't changed a bit. The same smell of grasses, bird calls, babbling water in the brook, the rush of wind through the trees. The same shadows of rustling leaves. The clouds above me look really close. I feel nostalgic to see them again, for they've become a part of me. While Oshima sleeps, I sit on the porch, sip tea, and read a book about Napoleon's 1812 invasion of Russia. Some 400,000 French soldiers lost their lives in that huge country in this massive, pointless campaign. The battles themselves were awful, of course. But there weren't enough doctors or medical supplies, so most of the severely wounded soldiers were left to die in agony. More, though, froze to death or died of starvation, equally terrible ways to die. Sitting there on the porch, sipping hot herbal tea, birds whistling all around me, I tried to picture the battlefield in Russia, and these men trudging through blizzards. I get about a third of the way through the book, and go and see if Oshima's okay. I know he's exhausted, but he's so quiet it's as if he's not even there, and I'm a little worried. But he's all right, wrapped in the covers, breathing peacefully. I walk over to the bedside and watch his shoulders rising and falling gently. Standing there, I suddenly remember that he's a woman. Most of the time I forget that, and think of him as a man. Which is exactly what he wants, of course. When he's sleeping, though, he looks like he's gone back to being a woman. I go out to the porch again and pick up where I left off in the book. Back to a road, outside Smolensk, lined with frozen corpses. Oshima sleeps for a couple of hours. After he wakes up, he walks out to the porch and looks at his car. The dusty, unpaved road has turned the green Miata almost white. He gives a big stretch and sits down next to me. "It's the rainy season," he says, rubbing his eyes. "But there's not much rain this year. If we don't get some soon, Takamatsu's going to run out of water." I venture a question. "Does Miss Sayaki know where I am?" He shakes his head. "No, I didn't tell her anything. She doesn't even know I have a cabin up here. It's better to keep her in the dark, so she won't get mixed up in all this. The less she knows, the less she needs to hide." I nod. That's what I had wanted to hear. "She's got mixed up in enough before," Oshima says. "She doesn't need this now." "I told her about my father dying recently," I tell him. "How somebody murdered him. I left out the part about the police looking for me. She's pretty smart. Even if neither of us mentioned it, I get the feeling she's worked out most of what's going on. So if I tell her tomorrow that you had something you had to do and will be gone for a while, and tell her hi from you, I doubt she'll quiz me about the details. Even if that's all I tell her, I know she'll just let it pass." I nod. "But you want to see her, don't you?" I don't reply. I'm not sure how to express it, but the answer isn't hard to guess. "I do feel kind of sorry for you," Oshima says. "But as I said, I think you two shouldn't see each other for a while. But I might never see her again." "Perhaps," Oshima admits, after giving it some thought. "This is pretty obvious, but until things happen, they haven't happened. And often things aren't what they seem. But how does Miss Sayaki feel?" Oshima narrows his eyes and looks at me. "About what?" "I mean, if she knows she'll never see me again, does she feel the same about me as I feel about her?" Oshima grins. "Why are you asking me this?" "I have no idea, which is probably why I'm asking you. Loving somebody, wanting them more than anything, it's all a new experience. The same with having somebody want me. I imagine you're confused and don't know what to do." I nod. "Exactly. You don't know if she shares the same strong, pure feelings you have for her," Oshima says. I shake my head. It hurts to think about it. Oshima's silent for a time as he gazes at the forest, eyes narrowed. Birds are flitting from one branch to the next. His hands are clasped behind his head. "I know how you feel," he finally says. "But this is something you have to work out on your own. Nobody can help you. That's what love's all about, Kafka. You're the one having those wonderful feelings, but you have to go it alone as you wander through the dark. Your mind and body have to bear it all by yourself." It's after 2 when he gets ready to leave. "If you divide up the food," he tells me, "it should last you a week." "I'll be back by then. If something comes up and I can't make it, I'll send my brother here with supplies. He only lives about an hour away. I've told him about you being here, so no worries, okay?" "Okay. And as I told you, be extra cautious if you go into the woods. If you get lost, you'll never find your way out." "I'll be careful." Just before the Second World War started, a large unit of Imperial troops carried out some training exercises here, staging mock battles with the Soviet Army in the Siberian forests. Did I tell you this already? No. Seems that I forgot the most important thing, Oshima says, sheepishly, tapping his temple. But this doesn't look like Siberian forests, I say. You're right. The trees here are all broadleaf types. The ones in Siberia would have to be evergreens. But I guess the military didn't worry about details. The point was to march into the forest in full battle gear and conduct their war games. He pours a cup of the coffee I made from the thermos, spoons in a dollop of sugar, and seems pleased with the results. The military asked my grandfather to let them use the mountain for their training, and he said by all means. Nobody else was using it after all. The unit marched up the road we drove here on. Then they went into the forest. When the exercises were finished and they took the roll call, though, they discovered that two soldiers were missing. They just disappeared, full battle gear and all. During the training, both brand new draftees. The army conducted a huge search, but the two soldiers never turned up. Oshima takes another sip of coffee. To this day, nobody knows if they simply got lost or ran away. The forest around here is incredibly deep, and there's hardly anything you could forage for food. I nod. There's another world that parallels our own, and to a certain degree, you're able to step into that other world and come back safely, as long as you're careful. But go past a certain point, and you'll lose the path out. It's a labyrinth. Do you know where the idea of a labyrinth first came from? I shake my head. It was the ancient Mesopotamians. They pulled out animal intestines, sometimes human intestines, I expect, and used the shape to predict the future. They admired the complex shape of intestines. So the prototype for labyrinths is, in a word, guts, which means that the principle for the labyrinth is inside you, and that correlates to the labyrinth outside. Another metaphor, I say. That's right, a reciprocal metaphor. Things outside you are projections of what's inside you, and what's inside you is a projection of what's outside. So when you step into the labyrinth outside you, at the same time, you're stepping into the labyrinth inside. Most definitely a risky business. Like Hansel and Gretel. Right, just like them. The forest has set a trap, and no matter what you do, no matter how careful you are, some sharp-eyed birds are going to eat up all your breadcrumbs. I promise I'll be careful, I tell him. Oshima lowers the top on the Miata and climbs in. He puts on his sunglasses and rests his hand on the gear stick. The forest echoes with the sound of that familiar roar. He brushes back his hair, gives an abbreviated wave, and is gone. Dust swirls around where he was, but the wind soon carries it away. I go back to the cabin. I lie down on the bed he'd been using and shut my eyes. Come to think of it, I didn't get much sleep last night either. The pillow and covers still show signs of Oshima having been there. Not him, really. More like his sleep. I sink down in those signs. I've slept for half an hour when there's a loud thump outside the cabin, like a tree branch had snapped and tumbled to the ground. The sound jolts me awake. I get up and walk out to the porch to investigate, but everything looks the same. Maybe this is some mysterious sound the forest makes from time to time. Or maybe it was part of a dream. I can't tell one from the other. Until the sun sinks down in the west, I sit out on the porch, reading my book. I make a simple meal and eat it in silence. After clearing away the dishes, I sink back in the old sofa and think about Miss Saiki. As Oshima said, Miss Saiki's a smart person. Plus she has her own way of doing things, the boy named Crow says. He's sitting next to me on the sofa, just as when we were in my father's study. She's very different from you, he tells me. She's very different from you. She's overcome all kinds of obstacles, and not what you'd call normal obstacles either. She knows all kinds of things you're clueless about. She's experienced a range of emotions you've never felt. The longer people live, the more they learn to distinguish what's important from what's not. She's had to make a lot of critical decisions and has seen the results. Again, very different from you. You're only a child who's lived in a narrow world and experienced very little. You've worked hard to become stronger, and in some areas you have succeeded. That's a fact. But now you find yourself in a new world, in a situation you've never been in before. It's all new to you, so no wonder you feel confused. No wonder you feel confused. One thing you don't understand very well is whether women have sexual desire. Theoretically, of course, they do. That much even you know. But when it comes to how this desire comes about, what it's like, you're lost. Your own sexual desire is a simple matter. But women's desire, especially Miss Saiki's, is a mystery. When she held you, did she feel the same physical ecstasy? Or is it something altogether different? The more you think about it, the more you hate being 15. You feel hopeless. If only you were 20. No, even 18 would be good. Anything but 15. You could understand better what her words and actions mean. Then you could respond the right way. You're in the middle of something wonderful, something so tremendous you may never experience it again. But you can't really understand how wonderful it is. That makes you impatient. And that, in turn, leads to despair. You try to picture what she's doing right now. It's Monday and the library's closed. What does she do on her days off? You imagine her alone in her apartment. She does the laundry, cooks, cleans, goes out shopping. Each scene flashes in your imagination. The more you imagine, the harder it gets to sit still here. You want to turn into a dauntless crow and fly out of this cabin, zoom out over these mountains, come to rest outside her apartment, and gaze at her forever. Perhaps she drives to the library and goes into your room. She knocks, but there's no answer. The door's unlocked. She discovers you're no longer there. The bed's made, and all your things are gone. She wonders where you've disappeared to. Perhaps she waits a while for you to come back, sitting at the desk, head in hands, gazing at Kafka on the shore, thinking of the past that's enveloped in that painting. No matter how long she waits, though, you don't return. Finally, she gives up and leaves. She walks over to her Golf in the car park and starts the engine. The last thing you want is to let her leave like this. You want to hold her and know what each and every movement of her body means. But you're not there. You're all alone, in a place cut off from everyone. You climb into bed and turn off the light, hoping that she'll come to you in this room. It doesn't have to be the real Miss Saiki. That 15-year-old girl would be fine. It doesn't matter what form she takes, a living spirit, an illusion. But you have to see her. Have to have her beside you. Your brain is so full of her it's ready to burst, your body about to explode into pieces. Still, no matter how much you want her to be here, no matter how long you wait, she never appears. All you hear is the faint rustle of wind outside, birds softly cooing in the night. You hold your breath, staring off into the gloom. You listen to the wind, trying to read something into it, straining to catch a hint of what it might mean. But all that surrounds you are different shades of darkness. Finally, you give up, close your eyes, and fall asleep.
38. Hoshino looked up car rental agencies in the yellow pages, picked one at random and phoned them. "I just need a car for a couple of days," he explained, "so an ordinary saloon's fine, nothing too big, nothing that stands out." "Maybe I shouldn't say this," the rental assistant said, "but since we only rent Mazdas, we don't have a single car that stands out, so rest assured." "Great. How about a Familia, a very reliable car, and I swear nobody will notice it at all." "Sounds good. The Familia it is. The rental agency was near the station, and Hoshino told them he'd be over in an hour to pick up the car. He took a taxi over, showed them his credit card and license, then rented the car for 2 days. The white Familia parked on the forecourt was, as advertised, totally unobtrusive. Turn away from it for a moment and every memory of what it looked like had vanished. A notable achievement in the field of anonymity. Driving back to the apartment, Hoshino stopped at a bookshop and picked up maps of Takamatsu City and the Shikoku highway system. He popped into a CD shop nearby to see if they had a copy of Beethoven's Archduke Trio, but the little shop had only a small classical section and one cheap, discount bin version of the piece. Not the million-dollar trio, unfortunately, but Hoshino went ahead and paid his 1,000 yen. At the apartment, a soothing fragrance filled the place. Nakata was bustling around the kitchen, preparing some steamed daikon and deep-fried flat tofu.
"I had nothing to do, so I made a few dishes," he explained.
"That's great," Hoshino said. "I've been eating out too much these days, and it'll be nice to have a home-cooked meal for a change. Oh, hey, I got the car. It's outside. Do you need it right away?"
"No, tomorrow would be fine. Nakata has to talk more with the stone today."
"Good idea. Talking things over is important. Whether you're talking with people, or things, or whatever, it's always better to discuss things. You know, when I'm driving lorries, I often talk to the engine. You can hear all kinds of things if you listen closely."
"Nakata can't talk to engines, but it is important to discuss things."
"So how's it going with the stone? You able to communicate?"
"We're starting to."
"That's good. I was wondering, is the stone upset we brought it here?"
"No, not at all. As far as I can make out, the stone doesn't much care where it is."
"Phew, that's a relief," Hoshino sighed. "After all we've been through, if the stone turns on us, we're in trouble." Hoshino spent the afternoon listening to his new CD. The performance wasn't as spontaneous and memorable as the one he'd heard in the coffee shop. It was more restrained and steady, but overall not so bad. As he lay back on the sofa and listened, the lovely melody got to him, the subtle convolutions of the fugue stirring up something deep inside. "If I'd listened to this music a week ago," he told himself, "I wouldn't have understood the first thing about it, or even wanted to." But chance brought him to that little coffee shop, where he sank into a comfortable chair, enjoyed the coffee, and listened to the music. "And now look at me," he thought. "I'm into Beethoven. Can you believe it? A pretty amazing development." He played the piece over and over, testing his newfound appreciation for music. The CD contained a second Beethoven trio, The Ghost. Not such a bad piece, he thought, though the Archduke was definitely his favourite. More depth, he thought. All the while, Nakata was off in a corner, facing the white stone and muttering. Occasionally he'd nod or scratch his head. Two men off in their own little worlds. "Does the music bother you?" Hoshino asked him.
"No, it's fine. Music doesn't bother me. To me it's like the wind."
"The wind, eh?" At 6, Nakata made dinner, grilled salmon and a salad, plus a number of little side dishes he'd concocted. Hoshino switched on the TV and watched the news to see if there were any developments in the murder case. But there wasn't a word about it. Just other news. A kidnapping of an infant girl, the usual Israeli and Palestinian reprisals, a massive traffic accident on a highway in western Japan, a carjacking ring headed by foreigners, some cabinet minister's stupid discriminatory remark, layoffs at companies in the communication industry. Not a single upbeat story. They sat at the table and ate their dinner. "This is really good," Hoshino said. "You're quite a cook."
"Much obliged. But you're the first person I've ever cooked for."
"You're telling me you never eat with friends or relatives or anybody?"
"Nakata knows many cats, but what we eat is very different."
"Well, yeah," Hoshino said. "But anyway, this is delicious, especially the vegetables."
"I'm happy you like it. Nakata can't read, so sometimes I made some terrible mistakes in the kitchen. So I always use the same ingredients and cook things the same way. If I could read, I could make all kinds of different dishes."
"Well, these are just fine."
"Mr. Hoshino,"
Nakata said in a serious tone, sitting up straight.
Yeah? Not being able to read makes life tough.
I imagine so, Hoshino said. The commentary with this CD says Beethoven was deaf. He was a famous composer, the top pianist in Europe when he was young. But then one day, maybe because of illness, he started to go deaf. In the end, he couldn't hear a thing. Pretty rough to be a composer who can't hear, you know what I mean?
I think so. A deaf composer's like a cook who's lost his sense of taste. A frog that's lost its webbed feet.
A lorry driver with his license revoked. That would catch anybody off guard.
But Beethoven didn't let it get to him.
Sure, he must have been a little depressed at first, but he didn't let misfortune get him down. It was like, problem, what problem?
He composed more than ever and came up with better music than anything he'd ever written. I really admire the guy. Like this Archduke trio. He was nearly deaf when he wrote it. Can you believe that? What I'm trying to say is, it must be tough on you not being able to read, but it's not the end of the world. You might not be able to read, but there are things only you can do. That's what you have to focus on, your strengths. Like being able to talk to the stone.
Yes, I am able to talk to it a little now. Nakata used to be able to talk to cats.
No one else could do that, right?
Other people can read all the books they want, and they're still not going to know how to talk to stones or cats.
These days, though, Nakata's having a lot of dreams. In my dreams, for some reason, I'm able to read. I'm not as dumb as I am now. I'm so happy, and I go to the library and read lots of books. And I'm thinking how wonderful it is to be able to read. I'm reading one book after another. But then the light in the library goes out, and it's dark. Somebody turned off the light. I can't see a thing. I can't read any more books. And then I wake up. Even if it's only in a dream, it's wonderful to be able to read.
Interesting, Hoshino said. And here I am, able to read and hardly ever pick up a book. The world's a mixed-up place, that's for sure.
Mr. Hoshino, Nakata asked.
What's up?
What day of the week is it today?
It's Saturday.
So tomorrow would be Sunday?
Normally, yeah.
Would you drive me tomorrow morning?
Sure. But where do you want to go?
Nakata doesn't know. I'll think about it after I get in the car.
Believe it or not, Hoshino said, I had a feeling that's what you were going to say. Hoshino woke up the next morning just after 7. Nakata was already cooking breakfast. Hoshino went to the bathroom, scrubbed his face with cold water, and shaved with an electric razor. They breakfasted on rice, miso soup with aubergine, dried mackerel, and pickles. Hoshino had a second helping of rice. While Nakata washed the dishes, Hoshino watched the news on TV. This time there was a short piece on the murder in Nakano. 10 days have passed since the incident, but the police still have no leads, the NHK announcer droned. An impressive front gate of a house flashed on the screen, cordoned off, with a policeman stationed outside. The search continues for the missing 15-year-old son of the deceased, but his whereabouts remain unknown. The search continues as well for a man in his 60s who lives in the neighborhood and stopped at a police station right after the incident to provide information regarding the murder. It remains unclear whether or not there is a connection between these two people. Because the inside of the house was undisturbed, the police believed that the crime was an act of personal revenge rather than a robbery that went wrong, and are investigating Mr. Tamura's friends and acquaintances. At the Tokyo National Modern Art Museum, where Mr. Tamura's artistic achievements are being honored, "Hey, Gramps," Hoshino called to Nakata in the kitchen.
"Yes? What is it?"
"Do you know the son of this guy that was murdered in Nakano, this 15-year-old?
"No, I don't. As I told you, all Nakata knows about is Johnny Walker and his dog."
"Yeah?" Hoshino replied. "The police are looking for that boy, too. An only child, it sounds like, and there's no mention of his mum. I guess he ran away from home just before the murder and he's still missing."
"Is that so?"
"A hard nut to crack, this murder," Hoshino said. "But the police are a pretty tight-lipped bunch. They always know more than they let on. According to Colonel Sanders, they're on to you, and know you're in Takamatsu. Plus they know some handsome guy like me's with you. But they haven't leaked that to the media yet. They're afraid if they let on we're here, we'll take off somewhere else. That's why they're insisting they don't know where we are, publicly. A delightful bunch, the police. At 8:30, they went out to the rental car and climbed in. As he settled into the passenger seat, Nakata had his usual thermos of hot tea with him, as well as his faithful shapeless hat, umbrella and canvas bag. As they were leaving the apartment, Hoshino was about to put on his Chunichi dragon's cap, when he glanced in the mirror and was brought up short. The police must know the young guy they were looking for would be decked out in a dragon's cap, green Ray-Bans, and in a lower shirt. There couldn't be many people with dragon's caps on here in Takamatsu, and with Ray-Bans and the shirt he'd stick out like a sore thumb. So that's why Colonel Sanders stocked the place with inconspicuous navy blue polo shirts. He must have anticipated this. Nothing gets by him, Hoshino thought, and tossed the sunglasses and cap aside. So, where to? He asked.
Anywhere is fine, Nakata replied. Just circle around the city.
You sure?
You can go wherever you like. I'll just enjoy the scenery.
This is a first, Hoshino said. I've done my share of driving, both in the self-defense force and with the truck company, and I'm a decent driver, if I say so myself. But every time I get behind the wheel, I know where I'm going and beeline it right there. That's just the way I am, I guess. Nobody's ever told me, you can go wherever you like, anywhere is fine. You're kind of baffling me here.
Nakata is very sorry.
It's okay, no need to apologize. I'll do my best, Hoshino said. He slipped the CD of the Archduke Trio into the player. I'll just drive all over the city while you enjoy the view. Is that okay?
Yes, that would be fine.
I'll stop the car when you find what you're looking for, and then the story will develop in a new direction. Do I have that right?
Yes, that's what might happen, Nakata said.
Let's hope so, Hoshino said, and unfolded the city map in his lap. They drove through the city, Hoshino marking each street on a block to make sure they'd covered everyone, then heading over to the next. They took an occasional break so Nakata could enjoy a cup of tea and Hoshino a Marlborough. The Beethoven trio played over and over. At noon they stopped at a cafe and had curry.
But what the hell are you looking for? Hoshino asked after they'd eaten. I don't know. But I think...
That you'll know it when you see it, and until you see it, you won't know what it is.
Yes, that's correct.
Hoshino shook his head listlessly. I knew what you were going to say, but I just had to be sure.
Mr. Hoshino?
Yeah?
It might take some time before I find it.
That's okay. We'll do our best. The boat's left the dock, and we're stuck on it.
Are we going to take a boat? Nakata asked.
No, no boats for the time being. At 3, they went into a coffee shop, where Hoshino had a cup. Nakata puzzled over his order, finally going with the iced milk. By this time, Hoshino was exhausted from all the driving and didn't feel like talking. He'd had his fill of Beethoven. Driving around in a circle, getting nowhere, didn't suit him. He had to keep his speed down and pay attention to what he was doing, and he was getting bored. An occasional patrol car would go past, and Hoshino did his best to avoid eye contact. He also tried to avoid passing in front of any police boxes. The Mazda Familia might be just about the most inconspicuous car on the road, but if the police spotted the same car passing by a few times, they might very well pull him over. He drove cautiously, making absolutely sure he didn't bump anybody. An accident would put everything in jeopardy. As Hoshino drove around the city, checking the map as he went, Nakata sat motionless, hands on the window, surveying the passing scenery, intently searching for something, for all the world like a child or a well-behaved dog. They each concentrated on their task until evening, and hardly a word passed between them.
What are you searching for?
Out of desperation, Hoshino started singing an Inoue Yosui tune. He couldn't recall the rest of the lyrics, so he made them up as he went along.
Haven't you found it yet? The sun is soon setting, and Hoshino's stomach is growling. Driving round and round sets my head spinning.
They went back to the apartment at 6.
Let's continue tomorrow, Nakata said.
We covered a lot of territory today. We can probably finish up the whole city tomorrow, Hoshino said. Hey, I got a question for you.
And what might that be?
If you don't find what you're looking for in Takamatsu, then what?
Nakata gave his head a good rub.
If we can't find it in Takamatsu, then we'll have to look further afield.
And if you still can't find it, then what are we supposed to do?
If that happens, then we have to search even more. We'll just make bigger and bigger circles and eventually we'll find it.
Like the saying goes, if a dog walks on, it's bound to bump into a stick.
Yes, I think that will happen, Nakata said. But Nakata doesn't understand. Why does a dog have to hit a stick if it walks? If there's a stick in front of it, the dog can go around it.
Hoshino puzzled this over.
Yeah, I guess you're right. I never thought about it before.
It's very strange.
Let's put the dog and the stick aside for a minute, okay? Hoshino said. That only complicates things. What I want to know is how far are we going to search? If we don't watch out, before we know it, we'll wind up in another prefecture. Ehime or Kochi or someplace. Summer will be over, and then it'll be autumn.
That may be, but I have to find it, even if it's autumn or winter. I know I can't ask you to help me forever. Nakata will just walk alone and keep on searching.
Let's not worry about that for now, Hoshino stammered. But can't the stone be a pal and give us a hint or something? Even an approximate location would help.
Nakata's very sorry, but the stone doesn't say much.
It doesn't strike me as the talkative type, Hoshino said. I don't imagine it's much good at swimming, either. Whatever. We don't need to think about it now. Let's get a good night's sleep and see what tomorrow brings.
The next day it was the same routine, with Hoshino this time circling the western half of the city. By now his city map was full of yellow lines. Only the increased number of yawns coming from the driver set this day apart from the previous one. Nakata kept his eyes peeled, intently studying the passing scenery. They hardly spoke. Whatever Nakata was looking for, he didn't find it.
Would today be Monday? Nakata asked.
Yep. Yesterday was Sunday, so today's Monday, Hoshino said. Then, almost in desperation, he made up a melody to some words that popped into his head.
If today is Monday, tomorrow must be Tuesday. Ants are hard workers, swallows like to dress up. The chimney's tall, the setting sun red. Mr. Hoshino, Nakata said after a while.
Yeah.
You can look at ants working for a long time and never tire of it.
I suppose you're right, Hoshino replied.
At midday, they stopped outside a restaurant specializing in eel and ordered the lunch special, a bowl of rice topped with eel. At 3, they went to a coffee shop where Hoshino had coffee, Nakata kelp tea. By 6 p.m., the map was a mass of yellow marks, the anonymous tires of the familiar having traversed every square inch of road in the city. But still no luck.
What are you searching for?
Hoshino sang again in a listless voice.
Haven't you found it yet? We've gone everywhere in town. My bum's aching, so can't we go home?
After he finished, he said,
We keep this up much longer, I'll turn into a regular singer-songwriter.
What would that be?
Nakata asked.
Never mind, just a harmless joke.
Calling it a day, they left the city, got on the highway, and headed back to the apartment. Lost in thought, Hoshino failed to turn left when he should have. He tried to get back on the highway, but the road curved off at a strange angle into a maze of one-way streets, and he was soon totally lost. Before he realized it, they were in a suburb they had not seen before, an old-looking, elegant neighborhood, with high walls surrounding the homes. The road was strangely quiet, with not a soul in sight.
I don't think we're too far from our apartment, but I have no idea where we are, Hoshino admitted.
He stopped in an empty car park, cut the engine, set the handbrake, and spread out his map. He checked the name of the neighborhood and street number on a nearby lamppost and looked for it on the map. Maybe his eyes were too tired, but he couldn't find it.
"Mr. Hoshino?"
Nakata asked.
"Yeah?" "I'm sorry to bother you, but what does it say on that sign over there on that gate?"
Hoshino looked up from his map and glanced in the direction Nakata was pointing, at a high wall with an old-fashioned gate, and next to it a large wooden sign. The black gate was shut tight.
"Komura Memorial Library," Hoshino read.
"Huh, a library in this deserted part of town? Doesn't even look like a library. More like an old mansion."
"Komura Memorial Library?"
"You got it. Must be made to commemorate somebody named Komura. Who this Komura guy is, though, I've no idea."
"Mr. Hoshino?"
"Yep."
"That's it."
"What do you mean?"
"That?"
"The place Nakata has been searching for."
Hoshino looked up from his map again and gazed into Nakata's eyes. He frowned, looked at the sign, and slowly read it again. He patted a Marlboro out of the packet, put it between his lips, and lit it with his plastic lighter. He inhaled slowly, then blew smoke out of the open window.
"Are you sure?"
"Yes, this is it."
"Chance is a scary thing, isn't it?"
Hoshino said.
"It certainly is," Nakata agreed.
39. My second day on the mountain passes leisurely, seamlessly. The only thing that distinguishes one day from the next is the weather. If the weather were the same, I couldn't tell one day from another. Yesterday, today, tomorrow, they'd all blur into one. Like an anchorless ship, time floats aimlessly across the broad sea. I do the maths and come up with today as Tuesday, the day Miss Saiki gives a tour of the library, provided there are any people who want to take it. Just like the very first day I came to the place. Spike heels clicking on the stairs, she walks up to the first floor, the sound reverberating through the stillness. Her shining stockings, bright white blouse, tiny pearl earrings, her Montblanc pen on top of her desk. Her calm smile, tinged with the long shadow of resignation. All these details seem so far away now, and no longer real. Sitting on the sofa in the cabin, the odor of the faded fabric all around me, memories of our lovemaking rise in my head. Miss Saiki slowly removing her clothes, getting into bed. My cock, not surprisingly, is rock hard as these thoughts filter through my mind. But the tip's not red or sore anymore and doesn't sting. Tiring of these sexual fantasies, I wander outside and go into my usual exercise routine. I hang onto the porch railing and go through an ab workout. Then I do some quick squats, followed by hard stretching. By this time I'm covered in sweat, so I wet my towel in the stream and wipe myself off. The cold water helps to calm my nerves. I sit on the porch and listen to Radiohead on my Walkman. Since I ran away, I've been listening to the same music over and over. Radiohead's Kid A, Prince's Greatest Hits, sometimes Coltrane's My Favorite Things. At 2 p.m, just when the library tour is starting, I head out into the forest. I follow the same path, walk for a while, and arrive at the clearing. I sit on the grass, lean against a tree trunk, and gaze at the round opening of sky through the branches. The edges of white summer clouds are visible. Up to this point, I'm safe. I can find my way back to the cabin. A maze for beginners. If this were a video game, I've easily cleared level 1. If I go any further, though, I'll enter a more elaborate, more challenging labyrinth. The path gets narrower, and I'll get swallowed up by the sea of ferns. I ignore this, and forge ahead. I want to see how deep this forest really is. I know it's dangerous, but I want to see and feel what kind of danger lies ahead, how dangerous it really is. I have to. Something's shoving me forward. Cautiously, I edge down a kind of path. The trees tower higher and higher, the air growing denser by the minute. Above, the massive branches nearly blot out the sky. All signs of summer have vanished, and it's as if seasons never existed. Soon, I no longer know if what I'm following is a path or not. It looks like a path, is shaped like one, but then again it doesn't, and isn't. In the middle of this stuffy, overgrown greenery, all definitions start to get a bit fuzzy around the edges. What makes sense, and what doesn't, it's muddled up. Above me, a crow gives out a piercing caw that sounds like a warning, it's so jarring. I stop, and tentatively survey my surroundings. Without the proper equipment, it's too dangerous to go any further. I have to turn back. Which isn't easy. Like Napoleon's army on the retreat, going home is more difficult than going forward, I discover. The path back is misleading, the dense vegetation forming a dark wall in front of me. My own breathing sounds loud in my ears, like a wind blowing at the edge of the world. A huge black butterfly, about the size of my palm, appears from the shade of the trees and flutters into my line of sight, its shape reminding me of the bloodstain on my t-shirt. It flies slowly across an open space, then vanishes among the trees. And when it has disappeared, everything suddenly seems even more oppressive, the air chillier. I'm seized by panic, not knowing how to get out of here. The crow squawks shrilly again, the same bird as before, sending the same message. I stand still and look up, but can't see it. A breeze, a real one, blows up from time to time, ominously rustling the dark leaves at my feet. I sense shadows racing past behind me, but when I spin round, they've hidden themselves. Somehow I'm able to make it back to my safety zone, the little round clearing in the forest. I flop down on the grass and breathe deeply. I look up at the patch of real sky above me a couple of times just to convince myself I've made it back to the world I came from. Signs of summer, so precious now, surround me. Sunlight envelops me like a film, warming me up. The fear I'd felt, though, clings to me like a clump of unmelted snow in the corner of a garden. My heart beats irregularly from time to time, and my skin still has a slightly creepy feeling. That night, I lie there in the darkness, breathing quietly, my eyes wide open, hoping to catch a figure appearing in the dark, praying for it to appear, and not knowing if prayers have any effect, concentrating for all I'm worth, wanting badly for it to happen, hoping that wanting it so badly will make my wish come true. But my wish doesn't come true. My desires are shot down. Like the night before, Miss Psyche doesn't show up. Not the real Miss Psyche, not an illusion, not her as a 15-year-old girl. The darkness remains. Just that. Darkness. Just before I fall asleep, I have a massive erection. Harder than any I've ever had. But I don't jerk off. I've made up my mind to hold the memory of making love with Miss Psyche untouched. At least for now. Hands clenched tight. I fall asleep, hoping to dream of her. Instead, I dream of Sakura. Or is it a dream? It's all so vivid, clear, and consistent, but I don't know what else to call it. So dream seems the best label. I'm in her apartment, and she's asleep in bed. I'm in my sleeping bag just like that night I spent at her place. Time's been rewound, setting me down at a turning point. I wake up in the middle of the night, dying of thirst, get out of my sleeping bag and drink some water, glass after glass, five or six. My skin's covered with a sheen of sweat, and the front of my boxers is tented in another huge erection. My cock's like some animal with a mind of its own, operating on a different wavelength from the rest of me. When I drink some water, my cock automatically absorbs it. I can hear the faint sound of it soaking up the water. I put the glass next to the sink and lean back against the wall. I want to check the time, but I can't find the clock. In this, the deepest hour of the night, even the clock's been swallowed up in the depths. I'm standing beside Sakura's bed. Light from a street lamp filters in through the curtain. She's facing away from me, fast asleep, her small, shapely feet sticking out from under the thin covers. Behind me, I hear a small, hard sound as if someone's turned on a switch. Thick branches cut off my field of vision. There is no season here. I make a decision and crawl in next to Sakura. The single bed creaks with the extra weight. I breathe in the smell of the faintly sweaty back of her neck. I wrap my arms gently around her. She makes a small sound, but continues to sleep. The crow squawks loudly. I look up, but I can't spot the bird. I can't even see the sky. I pull up Sakura's t-shirt and fondle her soft breasts. I tweak her nipples as if I'm adjusting a radio dial. My rock-hard cock slaps against the back of her thigh, but she doesn't make any noise, and her breathing stays the same. She must be dreaming deeply, I think. Again, the crow cries out, sending me a message, but I can't work out what it's trying to tell me. Sakura's body is warm, her body as sweaty as mine. I decide to pull her round to face me, slowly pulling her closer so that she's face up. She exhales deeply, but still she doesn't show any signs of waking. I rest my ear against her paper-flat stomach, trying to catch the echoes of the dreams within that labyrinth. My erection's not letting up, so rigid it seems as though it'll last forever. I slip off her small cotton panties, taking my time to get them down her legs and off. I rest my palm against her pubic hair, gently letting my finger go in deeper. It's wet, invitingly wet. Slowly I move my finger. Still, she doesn't wake up. Lost in her dream, she merely exhales deeply again. At the same time, in a hollow inside me, something struggles to break out of its shell. Before I realize what's happening, there's a pair of eyes turned in on me, and I can observe this whole scene. I don't yet know if this thing inside me is good or bad, but whichever it is, I can't hold it back or stop it. It's still a slimy, faceless being, but it will soon break free of its shell, show its face, and slough off its jelly-like coating. Then I'll know what it really is. Now, though, it's just a formless sign. It's reaching out its hands that won't be hands, breaking apart the shell at its softest point. And I can see each and every one of its movements. I make up my mind. No. Actually, I haven't made up my mind about anything. Making up your mind means you have a choice. And I don't. I strip off my boxers, releasing my cock. I hold Sakura, spread her legs, and slip inside her. It's easy. She's so soft, and I'm so hard. My cock no longer hurts. In the past few days, the tips become even harder. Sakura's still dreaming, and I bury myself inside her dream. Suddenly she snaps awake and realizes what's going on. Kafka, what are you doing? It would seem that I'm inside you, I reply. But why? She asks in a dry, raspy voice. Didn't I tell you that's off limits? I can't help it. Stop this now. Get it out of me. I can't, I say, shaking my head emphatically. Listen to me. First of all, I've got a steady boyfriend, okay? And second, you've come into my dream without permission. That's not right. I know. It's still not too late. You're inside me, but you haven't started moving.